today. Does it matter that the pandemic has turned so many of us into Amazon addicts?
John, cards on the table. I know I shouldn't be into Amazon, but I am quite into Amazon. And in fact, it's still 9:30 and this morning I've already thought about using it three times. I've used Alexa. I went to swipe buy now to buy a Lego figure. And I've realised I haven't got anything from the supermarket. So the only one where I seem to be able to get it quick enough is Amazon Fresh. And it's so far beyond that as well, isn't it? I mean, even though I try to buy real books, when I desperately wanted the second one in a series the other night, I went to my Kindle and we watch Amazon Prime. I mean, this is the society we live in, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I use Amazon as well. This morning I went looking for John Lennon glasses on there.
John Lennon glasses.
Because my son's got to school dressed as John Lennon on Friday. I mean, all of these sort of mundane details of your life intersect with using Amazon for millions and millions of people, and I'm one of them. You know, as an illustration of how sort of omnipresent it is, when I came to write this big piece about Amazon for The Guardian, I knew that I had to go and read about Amazon in a book. And of course, what did I do? I logged onto Amazon and I bought a book called Amazon from Amazon. And Amazon then delivered it. And that's the way the world works.
Guardian columnist John Harris has been reporting on Amazon's role in our lives, something that's only become a bigger deal through the course of the pandemic.
The point is that the sort of omnipresence of Amazon that we all know as an aspect of our everyday lives also points to very, very big questions about the company and its influence and reach, the way that it treats its workers, all of those things, you know. The very fact that it's in the foreground means that we should be asking questions, and journalists in particular should be asking questions. And I suppose, thinking about Amazon for the last month, that's what I've tried to do.
Speaking to warehouse workers and high-profile former executives at the company, John's reporting looks at how Amazon is run and what it would take to make it better. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, can Amazon be fixed? John, we know how much people rely on Amazon, but perhaps never quite so much as when we entered lockdown and suddenly all the shops shut, you couldn't get a booking slot for supermarkets, and you were stuck at home, maybe with kids to entertain. If there were winners from the pandemic, Amazon must be near the top of the list.
Well, I mean, I've spoken to retail analysts in the last few weeks who told me that, as far as they can tell, Amazon is the only retailer which is going to emerge from this as an unquestioned winner. So by a mixture of accident and design, if it didn't define the core of people's consumer experience before, it unquestionably does now. It's everywhere.
On the other side of that simple swipe and buy now is a vast network of supply lines that loop back to giant warehouses in which we know the working conditions are, at the very least, grueling at times.
Yeah.
When did you start looking into what effect the pandemic has had on Amazon workers?
It was essential that the voices of Amazon workers were in this piece. Now, they're quite difficult to speak to on the record in the sense that, like a lot of people who work in the logistics and retail part of the economy, talking to the press is not seen as being good form. So the people that I spoke to, although some of them spoke on the record, other people spoke anonymously and insisted their names were changed and so on, but it doesn't really detract from the vividness of what they talked about and the sense that they convey of what it's like working in a so-called fulfillment center.
Totally understandable that many people wouldn't want to speak with their names, but you did speak to one worker in Newark, New Jersey, named Courtney Brown. What was her job like before the pandemic?
Courtney Brown is a supervisor.
I am a process assistant. I'm a supervisor now. I run.
And she works at an Amazon Fresh warehouse, which supplies fresh food.
Basically, I am in charge of making sure all customer orders shipped out and, you know, everything makes it out on time.
she works from 6 in the evening till 5:30 in the morning. She gets $17.30 an hour. And she told me, really, that she'd never worked so hard.
But now it's not so much as change. It's just like an increase in work. Like, it's a lot. It's tiring. Like, I never used to come in as early as I used to. I never had to leave as late as I used to. And, you know, it's just on your body after a while. It's so tiring. It's so, like, thinking about it makes me want to cry.
That because of this huge surge in demand related to the pandemic and lockdown and so on, her sense really is that she and her colleagues have kind of outgrown the warehouse. You know, the facilities can't keep up with this huge upsurge in demand.
It's to the point where every week or sometimes every day, we're literally breaking records. Everyone has come to the realization now that we have actually outgrown the warehouse.
She says they haven't stopped hiring.
We haven't stopped hiring since the pandemic started. We have not stopped hiring.
More and more people are coming to work there.
So clearly her role has changed since the pandemic began.
I mean, it's not changed. It's just it's got more and more frantic. And she said, for example, that the workforce may have outgrown the warehouse to the extent that people are being forced to take lunch breaks in their car because the canteen at the warehouse, this is partly because of social distancing measures, is just constantly full.
Our break rooms aren't, you know, sufficient enough, like with the fact that we have to stay 6 feet apart. It's not enough space in the break room to have all of us on break. They have this huge setup outside, like it's a tent.
She said there were kind of marquee tents in the car park outside where people spent their breaks.
And then it got to the point where, too, they were just like, okay, well, that wasn't enough. So, like, a lot of people, they usually, they go to their cars.
Because the sort of physical infrastructure of the facility is too small for the huge surge in demand.
And she's obviously in the US, in New Jersey, like you said. Are there people in a similar position here in the UK? And did you speak to any of them?
Yeah, so I spoke to a woman who in the piece is called Anna, who works at an Amazon warehouse in the south of England. She said similarly that there's a real sense among the workforce that demand has surged inevitably, that that's kind of very obvious. But then she talked about things that precede the pandemic that are just a sort of ingrained part of doing certain jobs for Amazon. She's a picker in a very, very automated warehouse. And what that means is she stands in a stationary position. And things called robot drives that are like little squat droids, they look like, you know, they're little orange robots. They scuttle around. And in response to the system telling them to go and get a DVD or a toy or a computer printer or whatever it is, they pick up these fabric four-sided shelving units and then bring them to the picker, who then looks at the four-sided shelving unit, compares it to an image on the screen, picks out the item that's required, puts it in a tote, which is a container, which then takes it to the people who make up the parcels, right? And she, according to the target she has to fulfill, she has to average the picking of 360 items an hour.
An hour?
Yeah, which works out as one item every 6.7 seconds.
I can see there's a challenge to scale up so massively at speed, but this is a multi-billion pound company that has the resources to put in place what's needed to protect its workers. What did Anna tell you it was like working for them as the pandemic hit?
Well, she said, and I quote, they hired a lot of people. I thought there should have been fewer people in the warehouse to have distancing. She talked about space in the canteen where people spend their breaks. They took out some of the tables because of 2 meter distancing, but it was impossible to find a free table or chair. You had to stand. And we have to understand this is very arduous work. Break times are very, very important. And she also said that in the first month, quote, I was asking for antibacterial gel for wipes, basic things. So she said the provision of those was insufficient. And she still has an issue with masks. She says you can only get one when you're starting your shift. That's a problem. You know, the basic blue mask, it should be changed, I don't know, every few hours, but people have to work with the same one the whole day, unquote. She also said that in the summer, where people were working frantically, the air conditioning in her warehouse malfunctioned. And so people were masked up and so on and working in conditions that she said were over or around 30 degrees C. It was very, very hot. Initially, Amazon raised workers' pay rates in the States by $2 an hour and in the UK by £2 an hour. That was withdrawn in June. So that boost to earnings has now gone.
And have you put all of that to Amazon? What do they say?
So in response to that, Amazon say, quote, since the earliest days of the pandemic, Amazon has prioritised the safety and health of its employees and has invested millions of pounds to provide a safe workplace. They say that successful social distancing measures have been put in place and $800 million have been spent on workplace safety. They say that in the UK alone, workers who are called associates in the Amazon vocabulary have been provided with 53 million masks, 2.6 million litres of sanitizer, 66 million pairs of gloves, and 244 million wipes.
That definitely sounds like a lot, but there are a lot of workers. And it doesn't chime with what Anna was talking about, although I know she was referring to that initial period when the pandemic first hit. What did Courtney say? Did she feel safe?
Well, she said that it's crowded in there very, very often.
You can't stay socially distant from anyone. You turn around, somebody's right there. You can't, you know, move or do anything without there being a lot of people, especially too for the amount of work that we have. We literally need an army. We don't even have enough people for what we do.
It's difficult for people in the warehouse to follow any distancing measures. And I suppose you can then ask the question of to what extent those things are being meaningfully enforced.
Do we know how many Amazon workers have fallen ill?
So not many companies across the economy release figures about rates or absolute numbers of COVID infections on their premises. Amazon didn't for the first phase of the pandemic, but around 2 months ago, they did release a figure for the US. So that was just under 20,000. I think it was 19,816 people, they said, had contracted COVID who worked at Amazon warehouses. Now, Amazon, in fairness to them, say that as a proportion of their workforce in the US, that means their infection rate is lower than in the population at large, but that number is there.
Okay, so that is one side, the darker side, if you like, of this huge, huge surge in demand. The other side is probably more to do with the business itself. So let's just talk about this. Given this huge surge of demand, how profitable has 2020 been for Amazon?
Well, it looks like, in terms of its revenues, it's just off the scale, really.
A big, big beat on both the top and bottom line. We've got revenue coming in.
Amazon reported its third quarter results. The company's revenues were $96.15 billion. Its net income increased to $6.3 billion in the third quarter. That's net income.
Well, the stock is up almost 2% here after hours, Mike. That's quite a bottom line beat here for Amazon. Operating cash flow increasing 56%.
Everything is going through the roof.
I mean, the numbers are so big that I have no sense really of what they mean, but I can tell they mean that Amazon has done very, very well. And so that leads me on to my next question. Is this a company that pays its taxes and plays fairly in the marketplace?
So there are huge questions about Amazon and its taxes. They pay their taxes all over the world. The question is how much tax they pay. So in September, it was reported that its sales in the UK had surged to £14 billion. But it had paid only £290 million in UK tax. Now, that, as far as I understand it, is because the level of profit that it declares is relatively small. But its turnover and its revenues arguably speak for themselves, and that's a huge source of controversy. So, for example, in 2018 in the USA, Amazon posted income of more than $11 billion, but the company paid nothing in federal taxes.
Nothing.
Nothing. And that's because they would say, well, they've only just started to turn a profit.
Coming up, the former Amazon executive who quit the company and then spoke out about its practices. So listen, you, as well as speaking to workers in factories, spoke to a number of people who've been thinking critically about Amazon's influence. And one of them is a high-profile engineer named Tim Bray, who made news when he quit his job at the company. Why?
So Tim Bray was a vice president very, very high up in Amazon's tech division. It was a really big deal when he went, because I don't think, certainly in recent history, anyone as high up in the company had quit and made noise about the company's behavior and its ethical record.
I thought that was the actual interesting part of the story. So grumpy old well-off white guy engineer rage quits. And I got literally thousands and thousands and thousands of responses on Twitter and LinkedIn and email and, you know, all the input channels. And overwhelmingly, 99.9% positive, warm, you know, really heartwarming stuff.
Straight away, you quit. And there's no need to do it the old-fashioned way and call a press conference. He wrote a blog post called Buy Amazon, B-Y-E, not B-U-Y, in which he accused the company of having a vein of toxicity. I mean, this is very pointed language.
Obviously, there was a button there that I touched, and I had no idea it existed. I genuinely had no idea.
He did say that Amazon had put massive efforts into warehouse safety, but said that the company treated employees in warehouses as fungible, as his word means interchangeable, units of pick and pack potential. That there was an ethical question about how Amazon treats its workers.
At the end of the day, you know, Amazon is not the problem. Amazon is a symptom of the problem.
Right.
The problem is insufficiently regulated 21st century capitalism that has, you know, progressed to a point where it's a cancer of unacceptable levels of inequality and wealth and power. And, you know, Amazon more or less apparently tries to play by the rules to the extent that any big company does. And, you know, the problem isn't any individual. It's not Jeff Bezos. It's the system that allows them to get away with doing this shit.
And he says that it now really falls to the authorities in the US and Canada, where he is, but also in Europe, to start to take action about these things.
So let's ask ourselves, how do we solve that ethical issue? Do we lecture Jeff and say, be nice, Jeff, you know, play nice, you know, be a better person? Or do we establish a legal and regulatory framework that simply makes it impossible to do what they're doing? Clearly, there is a substantial level of feeling in the broader society which has become quite negative about big tech. But, you know, for those of us who spent our lives inside it, I can remember it wasn't that long ago when we were kind of, you know, the brave band of merry men making the world better, and our leaders were sort of sainted characters. And now, you know, there's a lot of people who think the actions of big tech are really damaging to society.
I do often think, if you're expecting the consumer to drive change when these companies are operating in a regulatory system that basically like lays out the red carpet for them, then how are you supposed to really get any serious change?
For me personally, the only sort of tension that I feel with this relates to this idea that you can't expect big companies like Amazon to behave any better because they just want to maximize their revenues and profits. And until government gets involved and compels them to behave better, they're not going to do so. Now, I can, of course, you know, I can see the sense in that argument. And ultimately, I suppose, if you're going to really, really ensure that things are different, that's how you have to do it. But also, it's not that long since there were very, very clear examples of more ethical capitalism. You know, I mean, they're kind of consigned to history, arguably, now. But there were companies like Cadbury's, for example, who treated their workers really, really well. It's not that long since there were companies who ensured that the wage differentials between senior management and the worker at the lowest level were not out of control. Now, those things are sort of museum pieces now, but they happened. And I think it's not unreasonable to ask the question that if Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who still owns 11% of its stock, is the first human being whose worth is now valued at over $200 billion, does that bring with it ethical obligations to the people who work for that company? And I would argue that it does.
John, it's clear from what you've told me that a company like Amazon is fundamentally changing things about the society in which we live. Some of those things in a positive way and some of them in a negative way. Clearly, there is a role for governments and regulation in dealing with that, and a role, I would say, for consumers. We do have to think about the way that we buy stuff. But to some extent, it feels as if the ship has sailed, that people are not just going to give up the convenience of swipe to buy now and all the other products they can get from a company like this. And certainly, the automation in the workplace that you've witnessed is to some extent here to stay. So I guess my final question is, what does all of this mean for our future?
It seems to me that you can't argue with automation. I mean, you can, right? If you want to be in the position of those people in history who tried to resist the introduction of agricultural threshing machines and all that stuff we learned at school about the spinning jenny and the water frame and the automation of textile manufacture. And a lot of people's lives were massively, massively disrupted by that stuff. But you couldn't really stop it. And I suppose the question then becomes, well, what are you going to do? If all of these people who up to now have been employed in retail are no longer employed in retail, what's going to happen? Now, optimists say that new opportunities will arise. And maybe those people will be employed servicing the robots that scuttle around the Amazon warehouses. Other people say, and I think this is a more likely answer, that that kind of stabilization might happen in the fullness of time. But in the short to medium term, there's going to be a hell of a lot of disruption. And what you do about that, I don't know. It's a very, very difficult question. I mean, I suppose in the end, you have to ensure that people can live while they're experiencing all this disruption. And I think ultimately, although I think this is about structural change, if you are a customer of Amazon, and I am, like millions of other people, I probably think there are questions you have to ask yourself. You know, are there other ways you can buy things? Not saying that you have to stop buying stuff on Amazon completely, but there are other ways of doing it that you might find more ethically satisfactory. There were retail analysts I spoke to in the course of this piece who said that before the pandemic, they thought we might be about to reach peak Amazon. You know, and down the years, what's tended to happen is when a company becomes sort of inescapable, people feel that there's something sort of unseemly or increasingly wrong about that and start looking for alternatives. And they wondered whether we got to that point and whether we might start collectively to question whether convenience does mean everything. Do you really need that 8 hours from when you order it? Is it absolutely necessary that your child's John Lennon glasses arrive by 12 o'clock tomorrow? You can wait until Thursday, you know. It is kind of strange, isn't it? I mean, I myself find this tremendously seductive. But you know what? I think I can wait another 24 hours before my book about the Beatles arrives. It's not going to hurt. Now, the pandemic and the restrictions that it's brought with it have sort of put that potential sort of moving away from Amazon on hold, because of necessity we want everything delivered now because we're not going out as much as we were. But it's interesting to speculate on whether Amazon might in the end become sort of unfashionable. But God knows, sitting here now with its profits and revenues increasing to the extent that they are, I don't foresee its power slipping hugely in the next few years.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was John Harris. Do go to theguardian.com to read his brilliant reporting on this. Amazon has responded to other points we made in the piece. The company has said its employment comes with industry-leading pay and competitive benefits, paying a minimum of £9.70 an hour in the UK or £10.80, depending on location. On the suggestion of a warehouse becoming uncomfortably hot during the summer, it has said that it has invested millions in air conditioning. We went to Amazon for a response on how much tax it pays, and a spokesperson said, "We are investing heavily in creating jobs and infrastructure across the UK, more than £23 billion since 2010. The UK has now become one of Amazon's largest global hubs for talent, and this year, we announced plans to create 10,000 new jobs in the country by the end of 2020, taking our total workforce to over 40,000. This continued investment helped contribute to a total tax contribution of £1.1 billion during 2019, £293 million in direct taxes and £854 million in indirect taxes. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.